LGIM Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals. Public opinion on the use of plastics has radically shifted. Companies like Starbucks are phasing out the use of plastic straws by 2020, and every major British supermarket has pledged to eradicate unnecessary single-use plastics by 2025. My guest today is Nick Stansbury, Equity Fund Manager and Head of LGIM's Research Strategy Group on the subject of energy. He's been crunching the numbers on what this battle against plastics means for investors, oil demand, and the world. Nick, welcome to LGIM Talks.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. So you've written this piece on what the battle against plastic means for oil demand. And I guess many investors wouldn't necessarily associate using fewer straws, using fewer single-use plastics with the demand for oil. It probably wouldn't factor into the asset allocation decision. So talk to me more about the concept of this piece.
So we've been aware for some time that there's been a growing public backlash against single-use plastics. We knew conceptually that single-use plastics were a big deal. We didn't know just how big a deal it was until we started scratching a little bit under the surface of some of the data and some of the market research studies that have been done in this area. The reason we wanted to focus on it was that we're very concerned around the destabilizing effects that peak oil demand, that's the point in time where oil demand stops growing, is going to have on the oil industry. And we wanted to look a little bit closer at the out years of oil demand forecasts by some of the major forecasters to try and understand how sensitive some of their assumptions that lead them to believe that oil demand will continue growing into the mid to late 2030s, and for some people even into the early 2040s, to try and understand how sensitive those assumptions were to the assumed continued growth in plastics demand that would be driven predominantly in the emerging world.
Okay, so I'd like to dig a little bit deeper and scratching on the surface of public opinion against plastics. What do you think really driven the change against plastics? I mean, we've been using plastics for 50 years and to a great degree.
I think that's right. So here in the UK, we like to point to the BBC series around Blue Planet 2 particularly, which I think for many viewers in the UK brought the subject right to the top of people's minds. I think it was shocking for many of us, particularly people like me who love the ocean, love to dive, and we're looking at some of these clips and utterly horrified by the damage that single-use plastics, in fact, plastics more generally, were causing in the ocean. But the issue is, I think, has been bubbling up in the public consciousness for some time all over the world. So I don't think it's fair to entirely correlate the growing backlash against plastics with just Blue Planet. But clearly, Blue Planet has brought the issue to the top of minds for many people, particularly here in the UK and elsewhere where BBC documentaries are widely distributed, which tends to be predominantly in the Western world.
In your piece, you lay out the governmental policies listed by, I think, about 15 different countries or states. And it goes back to about 2003 when Ireland introduced their plastic bag tax, which we currently have as of 2015. And you have places like Rwanda, where you have heavy fines for single-use plastic. And you have many of these other places. But the deposit return scheme for Germany, which I think has been muted for possible introduction here in the UK. But it seems to be that all of these kind of, we're still missing the two major players, that is the US and China. So what's happening in those kind of the major economies to deal with plastics?
So when we started looking into government responses, we started compiling up a list of all of the governments or all of the countries around the world which had introduced some sort of measure, regulatory measure to limit plastic use, limit single-use plastic use. And we quickly realized we were approaching the problem the wrong way. We should actually have been looking for those countries where there haven't been a regulatory intervention, because that list is an awful lot shorter. You're right. The only two countries to have not introduced some really wide-reaching measures are the US and China. But even in China, we've started to see significant regulatory and government intervention into this market. The key country is undoubtedly the US, where at the moment we haven't yet seen a response. But that doesn't mean that we're not likely to see one.
Okay.
And it's also important that the area we're focusing here on is not the absolute level of plastic consumption. It's the growth in plastic consumption, whether or not we are going to continue to see demand for single-use plastics growing at the same rate that we've always done historically.
What is that rate?
So we've seen demand for single-use plastics grow something like 20-fold over the past 50 years. Some people would expect that rate to continue and to see demand growth maybe double again over the next 20. So that's a rate of growth that correlates fairly closely with GDP.
So perhaps a lot of people's predictions are based upon, as emerging markets move towards more developed market status, that they will continue to use plastics at the same rate, introduce more plastics to a degree that we have currently seen in the developed market world.
Yes, exactly, which helpfully makes the lack of a US regulatory intervention a lot less important for the central research conclusion that we think we've reached here, which is not that the absolute level of consumption of single-use plastics is necessarily going to fall that much, although we think it will. It's that it is not going to grow anywhere like the rate that some forecasters are assuming today.
Okay, so we've talked about how many governments have introduced policies to limit the growth. What about the plastics that are already in the ocean? What's the scale of the problem that we currently have, as highlighted by Blue Planet 2?
So the scale of the problem is mind-boggling, and we're only just beginning, I think, to realise just how much money it's going to cost if we want to clean it up. So the central problem around single-use plastics is that the very attributes that make them so appealing when first used, the fact that they're incredibly lightweight, the fact that they're incredibly cheap, the fact that they're incredibly durable, those three central aspects then become the central problem for single-use plastics when you come to dispose of them. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're very cheap means that consumers haven't paid any money for them, which means consumers don't worry about what happens to them. The fact that they're very lightweight means that it's very easy for those plastics to escape from collection systems, which is why so much plastic packaging escapes into the environment. It's why we see so much of it fluttering around on our streets, and it's why so much of it escapes into the ocean. And the fact that it's so durable then becomes the biggest problem, which is that it doesn't degrade naturally and quickly when it does escape into the natural environment. It lasts for years and years and years. In fact, some people estimate that over the past 50 years, there are still components of plastics that are in the ocean today that may be as much as 50 years old.
Oh, my God. So back to, actually, what is that, 1980? I'd like to ask then, for the plastics that already exist in the environment, of cleaning it up, what are the industry responses to this is how we deal with the plastic waste that we've currently got?
So I don't think that anybody has a credible plan for dealing with the plastic pollution that exists in the environment today. Various people have tried different estimates to work out how much it would cost. And the numbers thrown around are tens of billions of dollars. Now, those are huge numbers. And if the petrochemical industry had to bear the burden of cleaning up the mess that their product has created, that would be a substantial dent in that industry's profit pool.
Oh, I'm sure.
So nobody has a credible plan for dealing with the problem. The question really becomes, how do we stop the problem getting any worse? And the standard industry response is to say, well, what we need to do is we need to incinerate all this plastics after they've been used. Incineration isn't quite as bad as everybody first thinks it is going to be. If you incinerate plastics in a very pressurized, contained environment, it's actually reasonably clean. The problem with it is it's incredibly carbon intensive. We ran some calculations to try and look at whether or not we thought disposing of plastics by incineration was going to solve this problem, essentially offer a get out of jail free card to the petrochemical industry. And we concluded that it isn't. And the reason is that when you include the energy that is consumed to make the plastic in the first place and realize that energy is almost always hydrocarbon based, and then you look at the amount of carbon that is then released when the plastics are burnt, it becomes a more carbon-intensive source of energy than burning coal, substantially more so, in fact. So we don't think, given the other policy imperative that is pushing along that we think is not going to slow down, in fact, it's only going to accelerate, of decarbonizing the world's energy system, that incinerating plastic simply doesn't fit into that direction of travel. So we're deeply sceptical amongst the sometimes suggested solution to this problem, which is that we grow the rate of incineration very rapidly. So we think the only solution is to cut down on the use of single-use plastics, okay. to look at substitutes, to look at recycling, and to look at alternatives. And by alternatives, we particularly mean bioplastics and other biodegradable packaging materials.
So I'm very non-aware of the chemistry that goes into it. I mean, can you talk to me about more about these bioplastics? Are they radically different from what's on sale today?
Yes. So bioplastics is one of those terms that's thrown around that that can mean an awful lot of things. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about anything from entirely organic materials, something like your entirely biodegradable plastic wrap or cling film that you might use in the supermarket, all the way through to extremely complicated organic chemistry derived plastic alternatives, which do have technical biodegradable characteristics. So there's a very wide spectrum as to what gets caught up under the umbrella term of bioplastics. We think some of the most interesting technology developments are going to be around using entirely organic matter to produce plastics that perform in their initial stages at around about the same level as conventional plastic packaging materials, but have none of the negative environmental externalities when you dispose of them. But those materials are going to be quite high cost. There's no getting away from the fact that that is going to bring significantly higher cost. And so we're going to also inevitably, we think, see a substantial pickup in recycling and see a substantial pickup in reuse, which is even more environmentally friendly than just recycling.
The recycling rates that we're currently seeing in the world, I mean, how much do they need to grow to help deal with the scale of this problem?
So I don't know how many people are aware of just how little plastic globally ends up being recycled. So it depends on how optimistic you are on the data. The best view of the data suggests that somewhere between 10 and 15% of single-use plastics end up being recycled.
That little.
So it's a very, very small amount. And when you look at the amount of recycled plastics that go into making other single-use plastics, it's very, very small, very low single-percent, single-digit percent numbers, 1, 2, 3%, that sort of scale. So the amount of recycling contribution to single-use plastics today is almost negligible. And that's amazing when you consider that in many developed market economies, the recycling rate is extremely high. So for some products, Switzerland has a recycling rate that is as high as 80%. And when we looked at the data for developed market best performers, we saw rates that averaged 50 to 60%. So we think there's an awful long way the world can go in terms of improving recycling rates. We also need to improve reuse rates, which are also very low and globally. But interestingly, that's an area where the emerging world has a lot to teach us, where they have been much better around using recyclable plastic bottles, for example, in the soft drinks industry, which we think has a place to play in solving this problem.
I'd like to take this back to an investor's point of view, selfish asset allocator's point of view, for instance. I feel like the research for you've done is a lot more complex to come to the answer that you should simply eschew all plastic packaging companies from your portfolio. What are the investment implications of what you found?
So there are lots. We chose to focus on two areas. And as with often with this sort of research, the answers are more complicated than we would like them to be. We always want really simple answers that say, as a consequence of this research, the right answer is therefore to sell every oil company you've got or sell every plastic company you've got. It is inevitably more complicated than that. The two areas of concern we had were around the long-term demand growth for the petrochemical industry, particularly for basic commoditized chemicals. So those chemical companies whose business is in producing the most basic of building blocks that go into the plastic industry, the plastic supply chain. So that's a lot of the global commodity chemical companies where we are cautious, but where the near term is actually reasonably supportive for slightly paradoxical reasons. So it's a little bit of a divergence to your question, but it's worth covering it, I think, because it illustrates why this is such a complicated subject matter. In the short term, we actually think the amount of recycling of plastics is going to start going down. And that's because recycling plastics is an extremely environmentally complex process. And what we've chosen to do as a world is to dump most of that complicated problem onto the emerging world, particularly onto China. And China, for a long time, has served as a dumping ground for lots of waste material, whether that's waste copper or waste plastics or waste paper. They've processed and taken a lot of it, and they themselves have borne the environmental consequences of doing that very cheaply. And as a country, they're starting to push back quite hard against the desire of the developed world to continue to use China particularly as the dumping ground for all of its waste. And we've seen that, there's been a number of moves by the Chinese government to stop the importing of low-grade waste materials for recycling and reprocessing in China.
Sorry, what counts as low-grade here?
So something like general mixed plastic recyclables, the sort of contents of your plastic recycling bin at home.
Wow.
Just get them all jumbled up into a great big truck. Low quality, it's all mixed together, which means it needs lots of labour to go into sorting it. It needs lots of processing, lots of waste chemicals that come out of the end of that processing line. That sort of mixed waste would historically have been bagged up and shipped to China. Just like another example is the copper industry, where very low-grade mixed copper would have been dumped into China for reprocessing and turning into new virgin copper for use in wiring or whatever. So as the Chinese have pushed back against playing this role, it's becoming quite difficult to find homes for some of this low-grade waste material. And what we're starting to see is a lot more of that material head towards landfill and head towards disposal.
Okay.
And that is actually causing recycling levels to start to fall. So we're seeing this in the short term is somewhat paradoxically, given the central research conclusions we've come up with, is actually going to be quite supportive to virgin plastic demand growth in the short term. By the short term, we mean anything up to the next 5 years or so. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to see the build-out of new recycling technology and recycling capabilities here in the Western world to deal with our own material in our own countries, which is probably what we should have done to start with.
Yeah.
So that's the paradoxical problem that complicates the picture for the petrochemical industry. For the oil industry, it's even more complicated. So since publishing our research, we've had a reasonable amount of pushback that says that we're over-exaggerating the size of this problem. So we've got back over our numbers, rethought, reconsidered, and actually stand by our original conclusions. The reason it's complicated for the oil industry is that today, single-use plastics is a very small component of end demand use. It's something like 2.5%, 3% there or thereabouts. Nobody knows the precise number.
And the rest of oil kind of goes towards, I mean, people's cars, aeroplane fuel, those kind of elements.
Exactly. The bulk of oil demand globally goes towards transportation uses.
Okay.
But what goes on inside some of the long-term forecasts, not everyone, some major forecasters have actually started to pick up on this issue like we have and are starting to acknowledge it and have brought down their long-term demand growth numbers by similar-ish sorts of orders of magnitude. But towards the end of most of those forecast periods, an invisible tug of war is going on. And what I mean by that is by the late 2020s, early 2030s, all of the major forecasters are now acknowledging that electric vehicles, decarbonisation, fuel efficiency, all of the factors that we all know about that are going to start to tug downwards on oil demand growth are going to be playing out quite hard. Today, electric vehicles, they're not really an issue for oil demand. They're such a small component of the global vehicle fleet. But given another 10, 15 years, and electric vehicles are going to be a really big deal. They're going to be really denting demand growth as electric vehicles substitute for traditional internal combustion engines. So you've got this one side of the demand growth picture which is tugging really hard in the shrink direction. And on the other side, you've got this growth in this area of oil demand which is loosely described as non-combusted, which is the part of oil, the part of the oil barrel that doesn't get burnt. So these are things like lubricants or asphalt for tarring roads, but very importantly for petrochemicals.
Yep.
And the petrochemicals component, a lot of that ends up going towards plastics, some, half of which is single use, half of which is not. They also require a significant amount of energy to be burnt as well, which is also an important part of liquids demand for the oil market. So by that, I'm including some of the natural gas liquids, which we tend to lump up with oil when we think about our barrels demand number. So you've then got in those forecasts this assumption that you've got these two forces, the petrochemical industry and the non-combusted sector, growing really fast and really hard, tugging against the electric vehicles and the fuel efficiency and the decarbonisation consequences, which are tugging on the shrink side. And the end effect of these two forces tugging very, very hard on this rope is that the flag that's tied to the middle of all of those tug-of-war ropes isn't moving very much. In fact, some forecasts have it by mid-2030 growing a very little bit. Some have it starting to shrink a little bit. It depends on the forecaster's assumption on which side of this rope is tugging the harder. Is it the petrochemicals, non-combusted bit tugging really hard? Or is it the electric vehicles and fuel efficiency part tugging really hard?
But their assumption that is still not going to move a great deal.
Exactly. And our concern is that we're worried that actually the petrochemicals non-combusted part may not be tugging anywhere near as hard as they think it is. In fact, we can imagine the picture in our own mind, can't we? You've got two teams of very, very strong men both tugging extremely hard in the opposite direction. What happens when one side of that contest just gives up and lets go is that, of course, the other side collapses really hard. And so what concerned us is, how many years worth of demand growth do we think might be destroyed if there was a really radical turning away from single-use plastics? Because that helps put this into a bigger picture type of context. And when we did that, we came up with this startling number that it might be as much as 5 years. Now, 5 years of demand growth is a lot. And the reason why it's so much is that in those later years of those forecasts, the consequence of those two sides tugging is that it moves a little bit to the grow side of the contest, but not very much. So oil demand in the 2030s for most forecasters isn't really growing very much. Therefore, if you take away a reasonably small component of demand growth, actually it stops growing and starts shrinking. And so we found that when we ran the numbers, and admittedly, we don't have access to necessarily the same depth of proprietary data that some other forecasters, like some of the big oil companies, have got. But on our best efforts basis, we thought that it might be as much as 5 years, which is a big deal because it starts to bring peak oil demand into the medium term for most investors, which is the sort of next 10, 15 type of years type of time horizon, rather than the next 20, 25 years type of time horizon. And that, for us, was a startling number and a startling conclusion. Because when we add it to all of the other things that we have that concern us around oil demand growth, it starts to make peak oil demand for us a much more imminent issue than we had previously thought.
It's something that investors should probably think about planning for a lot earlier than they... And with a 20-year horizon, you can think, OK, well, I can plan to plan for peak oil demand. But when you come to our conclusion, which is... medium term, then actually those plans need to start happening relatively soon.
Yeah, we think that's right. And again, the conclusion of peak oil demand being something that might occur in the very early part of the 2030s, the investment conclusions that, again, unfortunately, are complicated, not simple. Mm-hmm. Peak oil demand doesn't necessarily mean the peak oil economics. In fact, there are a number of examples in sort of investing history where industries have stopped growing and started shrinking and have actually ended up being very, very profitable and very cash generative. The concern is that demand growth has always acted as a stabilizer for oil markets. We use the analogy of a child learning to ride a bike. When you put a child on a bike, you don't just put them on the bike and let them off they go. You put two little stabilizing wheels on either side. And those stabilizing wheels, every time the child leans too far to one direction or too far to the other, they bounce off the stabilizing wheel and the bike stays upright. And in oil markets, the same thing goes on. We've got these two famous, really, stabilizing wheels of oil markets. And one of those stabilizers is demand growth, which is that every year, demand growth historically grows by 1.5 million barrels of oil per day, per year. And therefore, if oil markets get oversupplied for some reason, some exogenous shock happens, you've got oil demand growth coming along working in the background to bring the oil market back into balance. The other of those stabilizers is this issue around declines or depletion, which is that if the industry stops investing, after a little bit of a roadrunner moment, where the roadrunner continues to run off the cliff and stays flat, once you take away the investing capex tap from the oil industry, existing production starts to shrink. And it's normally the combined effect of these two stabilizers that has helped to bring oil markets back into balance. Our concern is that peak oil demand is essentially removing one of the two stabilizers. And for us, it's actually the more important one mathematically. Mm-hmm. And so the conclusion or the consequence of that for us is that when we start to get close to the point of peak oil demand, we could see oil price volatility start to increase. We see cycle lengths get a lot longer, and we see a market which, even though it looks optically very volatile, may turn out to have been an extremely calm period in oil markets compared to what it looks like in the future. So we think you have to think about raising your risk tolerance to continue to invest in the oil sector as you look forward to this. But you also have to be very, very careful that you are engaging proactively with the oil companies that you are investing in, with the management teams and the boards, to make sure that you're investing into companies that understand the uncertainties and the risks that lie ahead for the oil industry, and that are going to, and that these management teams are going to invest and are going to behave in a very sensible and rational fashion as we head into this period of uncertainty.
So you're asking investors to ask their investment manager to make sure, have you considered the risks? Have the companies that they are investing in considered the risks to the future of oil demand? And what if peak oil demand moves forward towards the medium term?
Exactly.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Nick Stansbury for joining us today. If you'd like to find out more about what the battle against plastic means for oil demand, we've linked to the full piece of research in the episode notes. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.